My guest on the show today is David Carpenter, CEO of Gameiotics. And good afternoon, hiya, however you say it over there. You're going to hear David is a fellow American, but he's not currently in America. One of the beauties of doing this podcast is I get to talk to people from around the world and also people who are from very close to me who are in a different place in the world. So good afternoon, David. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you doing, Jason?
I am doing fantastic. So where are you coming in from?
So I am currently in Edinburgh, Scotland. I am at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival all August with doing a product release for something that's associated with my software company. So I am here making sure that everything is going well. And today happens to be my one day off that I get within the entire month. So I'm actually really happy to be here because I don't have to think about this. I don't have to be doing the show today.
Yeah. Well, I'm flattered that you're making time for us to even come on a podcast. I would probably have not done anything or go to the pub or whatever.
No, it fit perfectly because I didn't have to leave my flat, right? So it was nice. Like, great. Like, this is perfect. I don't have to go anywhere. It's great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm so glad you're with us. I'm so glad you were able to make the time. We're going to get right into it. And the last thing I want to say before we start is, as soon as we got on, I said, this is going to be a fun interview because you're wearing a Star Wars shirt. And anybody who's a fan of this show knows that I'm a Star Wars fan. I've talked to some guests about Star Wars versus Star Trek. And that's been a thing for a few guests, and I'm team Star Wars, although I like Star Trek, but I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and I've had a lot of fun assimilating my 6-year-old into the Star Wars universe.
Oh, she loves it too. It's fun. Oh, that's so great. I mean, like, you have to start. Have you taken her through Clone Wars? Like, you have to start at the beginning, get through that first season, and then go. Like, I highly recommend that to get a small child integrated into it.
No, we actually started with the three trilogies. We started with 4, 5, 6. Went to 1, 2, 3, wrapped up a 7, 8, 9, and then we've watched Mandalorian, we watched Boba Fett, and then she got scared in Obi-Wan Kenobi for whatever reason, so she's not willing to watch that, and I said, why? I think she's scared of Darth Vader.
That's such an interesting thing, because Obi-Wan was such a family show, right? Like, it was, we watched it. I did not like it as much as Mandalorian, which I think is, you know, the current gold standard in terms of what they're doing in the TV projects, but I enjoyed it. I had friends who hated it, right? Like, who didn't like it. But it was also like, it's like watching Doctor Who. Are you a Doctor Who fan at all?
I am not.
All right. So I'm a big Doctor Who fan. And my husband is an even bigger Doctor Who fan. Started watching, you know, going all the way back to the 1970s, the 60s and 70s when it originally came out. And so I started watching it when they rebooted it. I think it was Russell Davies rebooted it with Christopher Eccleston. And my friends over here in the UK, when I was going through this, were like, you know, that's a kid's show, right? I'm like, what? They're like, Doctor Who is a kid's show. And I'm like, but that isn't how they present it to Americans at all. And I'm like, and I don't care. I love the show.
You're like, I love it.
Yeah. Over here, considered it. I mean, like, but that's has a kid's show and family entertainment have kind of different connotations, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. And I think they meant closer to family entertainment than necessarily, you know, children's programming.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. That's good. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun assimilating her. And we'll get to Obi-Wan at some point. I don't know. I think it's just Darth Vader. It's like scares her or something. All right, David. So speaking of Star Wars and Doctor Who and Star Trek, you and I like that stuff. Other people may say it's a little nerdy. So what's something else you nerd out about?
So I'm a big board gamer. I love board games. I'm super competitive in my life and also, when I'm playing board games as well. And the most recent one that I was really, really into was this game called King's Dilemma, which we play with about 5 people. And so we did it. All my friends, my little pod up in Peekskill, New York, which is where I live, started playing this during the pandemic. And I think it took us 6 months maybe to finish the game, right? We get together on one Saturday game. Or every other Saturday. Yeah, one game, right? What happens is that you're a group of counselors, right? You all have a backstory, you all have all these objectives and all this. It's a really kind of intricate game. What's happening is you're opening these sealed envelopes and it's revealing what the dilemma is, right? And you as the counselors have to make a decision that affects it and then also affects your scoring and your points and everything that's going along. And so it's a choose your own adventure kind of game because you open up all these envelopes, but you only open maybe 2/3, maybe half of the total envelopes that are in the box. And the rest of them, you never get to see because you didn't decide to go down that pathway in the series of decisions you made. So it's this really, really cool, interesting, very intricately designed game. And it's a one and done, which I'm not always the biggest fan of one and done experiences, but like this one was like, I would buy the game again and play with other people just to play it again. Right.
That sounds cool.
That's how much I loved it. Yeah.
That sounds cool. I'll give you two things on this around my life. One, my wife and I were big Catan players. I don't know if you're like,
sure.
Catan is to me is the gold standard for one night, couple hours, get two other friends. If you're playing as couples or playing with four up to six people with the expansion, that game just never gets old. I don't know what it is about. It's just brilliantly designed.
I downloaded it on my iPad. So I used to play it on the train back and forth in New York City just so I could get better at it when we would play with friends. So we actually had to put it on the shelf for a while. The other one that we play is Munchkin, right?
Never played Munchkin.
You've never played Munchkin?
No.
Munchkin's fantastic, but like it's a lot of RPG games, you know, there's elements of D&D that are in it as well. But it, you're basically assembling a character, a class, you know, a race and a class, and all these different attributes that are or weapons or armor or whatever that's going with it, in order to kind of proceed through this 10-level dungeon. And I say it's a single path, right? There's no variance to it, and you're competing against everyone. And the whole thing about Munchkin is the game's really about stabbing your other fellow players in the back. Like, that's really what it is, right? Nice. So, like, when we started it, I hadn't played it, and we started it, and I was like, God, this game is evil, right? Like, this game is really, really evil. And then a friend of mine, actually my partner that I'm over here with on this venture that I'm doing now, pulled me aside and was like, you can never play this game with malice, right? You always have to play it with mischief, but never malice, because if you just get into stabbing people in the back, no one will ever play with you again. And I was like, we were getting dangerously close to that. Right.
I do. I play games that are very similar. They just happen to be on a big screen TV through my PS5 or Xbox instead. Yeah. But all the same, you know, all the same things are happening in the background around like the roles and everything. It just happens to be, I'm a big video gamer. So everything. Oh yeah. RPGs.
What are you playing right now?
I'm still playing Elden Ring.
Okay, I missed my opportunity this summer to start getting into it, because then I had to. I'm away from home for the entire month of August, and everyone keeps saying to me, "You've got to play this game. You got to play this game." I did weird thing where I went completionist on Hollow Knight on my Switch, I ended up putting like well over 100 hours into that game, and I was like, "I need something less intense right now than what I just did."
The game is an unbelievable game. Like, and if you know the story of that game, you know, as a little Australian developer, and it's just considered one of, like, arguably the greatest Metroidvania game of all time already. It's just, that's an incredible game. The story building and the world building.
That's what I'm playing right now. I'm playing Metroid as my way to ease off from what I just did on Hollow Knight. Right.
So good. I know. That's great. David. All right. So let's talk about your comfort zone. What's something that is inside of your comfort zone that you know is outside of other people's?
There's something that's inside my comfort zone that I know is outside. I mean, this relates a lot back to business, but just my risk taking ability, right? I mean, so I've worked in live entertainment for 22 years. I think for well over the last decade, I've been a producer in live entertainment. And then I started a software company, which is Gameotix, a few years ago. And one of the things and it was mostly Broadway and off Broadway, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, and this is specific to the little bubble, weird little bubble that Broadway and off Broadway is, especially within theatrical, live stage theatrical entertainment, it has to do with risk, right? And lots of people call themselves producers on Broadway. If anyone ever says, like, hey, I'm a producer on Broadway, I can give you a series of questions to ask to determine if they're a producer, like a lead
fundraiser,
or whether they're actually just a investor and
a money person,
right? Money person, right? It's this weird thing. I think it's just that ego trip of saying like I'm a producer. Whenever I say it of things that I'm not, that I wasn't, you know, in charge of, I would say, oh, I was a co-producer, right? Like I helped raise money and that's all I did. Because the producer is the one who makes decisions, right? So that's the thing. It's like whoever says, well, I was a producer on Broadway, is like, did you make a decision? Like, did any decision actually ever come to fruition? Or did you sit at a meeting and people ask your opinion? There's a difference. But you know, you have to learn how to finance before you can become a lead producer. I mean, it's a big part of it. So like there's a number of people who kind of go through the ranks and friends of mine who are just in awe of in terms of a lot of stuff that they've done, where they start as co-producers and working on other people's shows, somebody having their own stuff, and then have proceeded over the years to become lead producers, right? Because like when you're starting a company, like you don't start. Like I think we get a little bit of misaligned with Silicon Valley. It's like you start a company and you're the CEO. It's like, well,
yeah,
no, you're going to have to work your way up to actually learning how to take charge of an organization, right?
Right.
So, but the difference in entertainment, specifically in entertainment, I think it's true in a lot of business, is your ability to take and manage risk, right? Mm-hmm. And there mm-hmm. aren't a lot of people who want that burden, because it is a burden that you take on to make it. Because at the end of it, it's you have to make a decision and live with it. And if it was a bad decision and you run from that bad decision, you're not a very good leader of your organization.
Right. You know? Yeah. Risk taking, so that makes it. Yeah.
Yeah. So my ability to take risk has gotten better, right? Like, but I've always been that. I've always had the ability to take risk. I think when I was younger, it's that nuance of that ability to take risk and make a good risk decision, right? Because when you're young, you have no data to really, you're just like, I'm going to make a decision. Right? Like, well, I made a lot of very bad decisions in my youth, right? But as you get older, you learn how to manage that and you learn how to do it. But I think the hardest part is that the risks just get bigger. And that's the thing that, that certainly I'm facing in my life right now. It's like the ability to take risks has never gotten, but the size of the risks just keep getting larger and larger. And that's been, you know, the CEO's job in any company is to manage cash flow, right? I mean, that's a massive part of what they do for a living. It's not even necessarily the CFO's job, as it is, like, certainly they're managing cash flow. The CEO has to ultimately be responsible for that cash flow management. And that's one of the hardest things I've ever had to deal with. And I certainly still deal with it, you know, on a daily basis. But when you're in startup mode and you're raising money, and you're staring at the ceiling at 3 a.m. being like, oh my God, I have payroll coming up in 2 weeks and I have not completely closed these deals that are sitting on the table. Right. And it's my partners in the venture, in this venture I'm here in Edinburgh, they're younger than me. They haven't been through this before, but they're also cognizant of being like, we don't want your job. Not right now. Your job is too hard. We have other jobs to do. We don't want your job. Like, that is crazy what you have to deal with. And it's tough.
Yeah. So much to dig into there. And I want to flip this on you and ask you about something that is outside of your comfort zone, something that you're unwilling to do, or just you really don't like doing. And you know, people in your sphere that's their thing, or it's inside of their comfort zone.
So what I'm really good at is long-term strategic thinking, right? Like setting up a vision, setting up a plan. And then, like, lots of people say that, but like, actually, like, the vision that I put for this company that I'm working on right now, but actually both companies, like, have borne out point step by step by step by step that I set, like, nice. That I set out a year or 3 years ago, right? So I'm really, really good at that. What I am not so good at is that nitty gritty, like, day to day detail management of certain aspects of how the company's run. I mean, like, getting a letter from the insurance company saying we need you to do this, or unemployment coming in and saying, hey, we need this piece of information. Like, it makes me want to pull my teeth out of my head, right? Like, that that stuff. And I know lots of people who love that detail in terms of that management of organizations. And I have people who work for me who absolutely love the accounting, right? They love seeing how the numbers match up on the balance sheet. God, no. Like,
good on them.
Right. Like, yes, I have to understand how a balance sheet. Yes, I have to understand how it works and where it needs to go. But like making those numbers all fit together in that way, like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if Rob Cassie is ever listening to this, who works for me in a couple of my companies, like, this is why you're one of my favorite people in the world, because you're just Rob, like, no, Cassie. I got this. Yeah.
But David, one thing. So I'm like you, I do not like that stuff either. I like the vision, the strategy, even something as simple as this podcast is one of the many things I do. I love talking to people. I love getting it. I love marketing it. Some of the more tedious things that I see as tedious to get a podcast out, I'm like, oh, I just pay somebody else to do it. So that's like, that is the one of the keys to leadership, is don't do the things you don't like doing, even if you could do them, because you can pay people. And a lot of times for certain things, as you're just starting out, you don't have to pay people a lot. You can have a virtual assistant do it. You can have people do it. It doesn't cost you that much. So I think that's great. You and I would be a great visionary team. You do not want me doing the books and getting the insurance letters and all those things.
But I would say you still have to understand people's jobs, right? Like, so like, I don't, I don't love social media, right? Like, it's not, not, you know, I'm, you know, I'm almost of an age where it happened, you know, during my lifetime. It happened during my lifetime. It wasn't something that I grew up with. Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you certainly see a generational divide of people who are like, you know, I do it. It's out of necessity, but people who were born into it effectively, it's like, oh, this is just the way the world works. Right. And you see that happen a lot of, certainly in technology in every generation. Right. Like cell phones. When my parents first got a cell phone, they're like, this is the devil. And I'm like, that's the neatest thing I've ever seen. Right. Like, yeah, it was like that type of stuff. Right. So it is so important from a marketing and a media strategy that you understand through and through the mechanics of it and where its place sits within your organization and how important it is. I mean, one of the things, that's one of the greatest things about working through Broadway in my generation is that the generation ahead of me did not understand that at all, right? And still don't understand how powerful it is as a tool to connect with customers. And they're really bad at it, right?
Yeah.
I got very lucky, if I'm allowed to go down on this tangent.
Please.
One of the shows that I produced off Broadway was a show called Puffs. And Puffs is a parody of the Harry Potter universe, right? And it was a very successful show. It ran for 3 years off Broadway, and it's now the number two most produced show in the U.S. right now.
Nice.
It was a fun experience.
That's cool.
It was a hard experience because it's a parody, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of rules in legal rules that surround how you can successfully produce a parody for commercial game, right?
Sure.
And I can't do it in the U.K. Like the rules are different over in the U.K.
Yeah.
And I can't do it. I could do it over here, but there's no precedent in the courts for it, and it's a really tricky battle to try and make that work. So, you know, letting that thing exist in the UK. But one of the things about it was revelatory in my experience in live entertainment, especially working on Broadway for so long, was, you know, the weird thing about Broadway is that people just come to Broadway, right?
Yeah.
And they said that for many years. Like, Broadway's the brand. Well, it's not really a brand. There's a lot of different products. You know, it's like a grocery store, right? And a lot of products, and you know, it's a really tricky business in its own right. When we started producing Puffs, we're like, well, we're producing content for a fandom, and it wasn't even necessarily just the Potter fandom. The people who care about fantasy and comedy and this kind of different take on looking at live entertainment and looking at like who they are in the world, right? And who also happen to know something about Potter, You know, everyone told me it wouldn't work, and everyone told me that, you know, I would never get through it legally, you know, like all that stuff. And what started happening, and that was like when I started off Broadway, we're in like 170-seat theater and three stories above next to a porn club. Like, it was terrible. It's in Midtown, right? And you know, we didn't really have much of a budget for marketing and advertising, and I was really leery about spending advertising dollars. So what I started doing is going to every wizarding convention, to every fantasy convention, everything around the country myself, like pack up the car, grab my husband and say, this is what we're doing for a week. And he'd be like, I hate your job. And we'd go and I just put out a table and be like, hey, I'm doing this show. Right. And we started,
that's cool.
What happened is we started connecting to a fandom of people who were like, I'd never go see a Broadway show or an off-Broadway show. I'd come see this. And then a light bulb went off in my head of saying like, oh, like Marvel, and obviously Disney figured this out years ago, right? But Marvel was figuring this out in the early 2000s of saying, we've got this content, we've got this idea, we can build a community around this idea and then kick out 20 of the most popular movies of all time.
Right.
Right. So this kind of shift for me that went from producing for a concept of what Broadway is to then producing for a fandom is where I took my career. Right. Because then it got so much more interesting for me in terms of what I was after. And like you say, where my Star Wars t-shirt today, it's like, I want to produce like everyone said, you know, when you're a producer and doing live entertainment, produce what you know, produce what you like. And I was like,
yeah,
I want to produce stuff for me and my friends. Right. And luckily, there's enough of us in the world to make profitable ventures. Right.
Yeah. That's awesome, dude. That's a super cool story. I love that. Definitely going to highlight that in the show notes about how you went from off Broadway, Broadway to doing what you're doing now. And we're going to talk more about that after we come back from the break. But before we go to the break, I want to ask you, if I was to give you 5 minutes, this is your 5 minute TED talk. And although we don't have the whole world listening to this podcast, because if we did, I'd be doing it from my yacht. or right. the from the moon or the Mars. I'd be the Elon Musk of podcasting. Give you 5 minutes and you could speak to us for 5 minutes on anything. What is it you'd, what is your message to us and what do you want us to do at the end of your speech?
So for me in this, I might not take up your full 5 minutes. I have a really, I have a really simple philosophy, right? And, mm-hmm. and, you know, working in entertainment for as long as I have, you have a lot of ego, right? That surrounds you at all time. You have a lot of detractors. You have, I think one of the hardest thing that I found, when I started working on Broadway is how many people root for your failure, right? Because your success is supposedly their failure, right? And it was a really, it was tough. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I don't work in Broadway anymore was this community that was built around this idea of other people's successes is your failure, right? And of course, I never bought into that because I think that's just an absolutely absurd way to work in the world. But it created this just sense of envy and jealousy, right? That permeates, you know, all throughout of it. But then, you know, you start having success, you start doing something right, or you have an idea and you have something about passion that you're pursuing, and it's like it just like spawns detractors, right? And I think that was also really hard to deal with, which is like I'm not harming anyone. I'm young and making mistakes and like in learning and doing all these things that I'm trying to do. But God, we're producing entertainment. We're not like going to war. Like I'm trying to entertain people. Right? So there's this like, why do we care so much about what everybody else is doing? And so like what I really started to do, and this certainly happened when I founded my first entertainment company on my own. I had another partner, but there's a company called Tilted Windmills that I had. It was a rough founding. There was a previous company that was right before it with a third partner who signed a contract and then walked away and never paid any of the bills. And we're like, oh God, like it was one of those terrible startup situations. You hear about them all the time. And at the time it was like, this is the end of the world. Well, it wasn't the end of the world, right?
Yeah.
What I just did, I was just like, you know what? None of this matters. Put your head down, do the work, right? Let the work speak for itself. Let the work be the thing that answers the detractors, that answers to all these other things. Stop focusing so much on what other people are saying or what other people think about you or any other thing, and let the work speak for it. Because if you believe in the work, if you believe in the thing you're doing, whether it is successful or not, like you have to learn how to manage your definition of success, right?
Yeah.
And it's tough in an industry that is not a real industry from a business standpoint. Like it is a fantasy land of crazy, right? Because the challenge on live theatrical is that the margins are terrible and the financing is coming in from people who are using as part of their high net worth individuals who are using it as part of their high yield investment strategy. I mean, I'm sorry, their high risk investment strategy, that section of their portfolio. That's what's there. So then you are creating, and this has been happening for decades now, you are creating an environment where loss is okay. Because like, well, we didn't fucking care about it to begin with. Sorry, apologize if I'm not allowed to swear in your podcast.
Nope, this is a checked explicit on the podcast. We're good.
So where, and that in itself breeds a weird conundrum of lack of caring sometimes about loss, lack of caring sometimes about the way the business should work. You know, it's a strange thing, right? That I could go on for another 5 minutes, but I won't, right? So I really just sat down and said, doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter how long it takes. It doesn't matter whether I'm successful or not. As long as I am doing the work, as long as I'm happy, as long as I'm delivering, as long as I am doing the things, the goals that I set up for myself, that is what my measure of success is. And as long as I am working as hard as I can on the product that I'm doing, right, and not sweating the small stuff of what else is coming at me, then that's what matters, right? And so, so it's this concept of you're only in a race with yourself, right? You only are. Like the only person that you are competing with is yourself. And stop worrying so much about what's happening in your peer group. Because I have peers who, you know, I go back in the other industry who are multiple Tony Award winners now. They've had really hugely successful businesses, right? And that's amazing for them. But it doesn't mean that I am any less successful at what I've done. What I have done in my career is something that they never could have ever done, right?
That's right.
Like in terms of the things that I've built and the strategy and the passion. And so it's I'm happy, like, and I want everyone around me to be successful, but at the same time, it doesn't, like, it's really just me against me, right? And making sure that I'm holding like myself accountable. And that's like, it's a weird thing in business because what they teach you is like, you know, find your competitor, right? Find your competitor. And like, you do that from a product standpoint, but as a person, as a CEO leading the company, I'm like, I'm not competing against them, right?
Yeah.
That isn't really what we're set up. There's no reward. There's no prize, right? There's no finish line, right? It's just, it's like, what do I want to get out of it? Right. So,
I love that, David. What I hear there is, it's an abundance mindset that there's actually enough for everybody. There's enough customers to make Gameiotix as wildly successful. If the show's good, there's enough people that are going to come see it. And you don't have to think that it's
product people come see it. I mean, that's right. It's so true, right? It's so true.
Yeah. A good product.
Like, if the product's good. So like, stop trying to cut everybody else down to get your thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that, David. We're going to take a brief commercial break. We'll be right back after this.
The Talking to Cool People podcast is brought to you by Jason Frizzell Coaching. Jason works with amazing people who are looking to find and develop their passion and purpose and create their journey to wherever it is they want to go. Check us out at jasonfrizzell.com, Facebook, or on Instagram. Jason loves hearing from anyone who thinks it would be cool to connect, to be coached, or to be a guest on our show. Email him at podcast@jasonfrizzell.com or DM him on Facebook and Instagram. And now, back to some more amazing conversation on Talking to Cool People.
All right, David, we are back. What else do you want us to know about you?
Oh, gosh. I'm a thorough animal lover. I had two cats, both of which recently passed within the last year, who were named Buffy and Spike. Our third cat is named Faith. And we just got a dog 3 months ago, a puppy 3 months ago named Willow. So we decided to go all in our lives on naming our animals after Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And have just stuck to it for almost 2 decades now.
What kind of puppy did you get?
So it's a rescue. And when we adopted her, they said she's a lab mix, which if anyone ever says that to you when you're adopting a rescue, that is a lie. because that's how they get dogs adopted. And we recognize the game when we got it. We're like, all right, lab mix, that's fine. Like this, what you're showing us right now is like, sure, there's lab in it, but like, let's see what else is going on. Right. Cause it's just weird. They'll never say pit bull, right? They'll never say, unless it's obviously a pit bull, right?
Right.
So any chance they have a chance. And like, pit bulls are amazing dogs. Like, pit bulls are some of the best dogs out there, but there's just this weird thing about them, right? So anyway, we did that DNA test, like shout out to Embark, which was a lovely company to do our DNA test.
Nice.
And she came back as a half pit bull terrier, right?
Uh-huh.
And then 15% Staffordshire terrier. And then 15% labs. We're like, all right, there's the lab.
Yeah,
and then 15% Great Dane. So that was the thing that threw us for a loop. And then it was 5% German Shepherd, right? And we're like, how big is this dog going to get? They're like, this is a 50-pound dog, and our vet was like, this is a 90-pound dog.
Right,
if you're lucky. Exactly.
Oh man.
So my husband wanted a small dog. We compromised on a medium dog, and we got a big dog.
You got a big dog. Are her paws already just huge?
Huge paws. Yeah. Huge paws. Oh, yeah. But one of my partners, when she first met her, she pulled me aside. She was like, that dog has Great Dane on it. I'm like, no. She's like, that dog has – I looked at her paws. That dog has Great Dane. And she was right. She was totally right about it.
Yeah. Well, David, as long as you don't have to get a new vehicle to support your dog, you know, I see Great Dane owners, which Great Danes are great dogs. I'm like, we would actually need another car. That's like having another – that's having a more than a bigger human in your life, some of these huge dog breeds.
So she's not going to be that big. We don't think she's going to be like 120 or 30 pounds. We think she'll cap out at 90, like we hope. So like, so that's good.
I mean, the
nice thing about having a mix like that is that she's a really, really intelligent dog. Is taken to the training so quickly. And so that is helpful. I mean, she, like any puppy, is destroying our house like one piece of furniture and shoe at a time right now.
Of course.
But, you know, she's really smart. So we're happy with that.
Congratulations. We're big dog people as well. We have we went the other way. We have a purebred English cream golden retriever because we are also, but we're crazy. We got her 4 months after we had our son. because we needed an infant.
It wasn't hard enough.
It wasn't hard enough with already a 4-year-old daughter at the time, and then an infant to get a dog. But and people go, oh, you should have gotten a rescue. I said, the reason we got, her name is Sunshine Rain, named by our 4-year-old at the time. Just
there we go.
If you ever see a picture of our dog, it fits her perfectly. She's pure gold and pure sunshine. Because we need something very predictable. So you've actually empowered my decision right now. Said we need a dog at a specific size with a specific temperament, and she's turned out exactly how we expected. We love rescues too, but we're like, we got a baby in the house. We cannot have any sort of danger or something too big. And that's
I would agree, especially with little kids like that. I mean, Jacob and I can handle ourselves with the dog, but if you're introducing infants into the situation, especially a 4-year-old, you don't want to take that kind of risk. And because the worst part is like, what you don't want to do is have to return the dog and destroy your 4-year-old.
No.
Right? And absolutely destroy
it. No.
Yeah. It happens.
David.
I mean, it happens.
Yeah.
Right?
Sad.
But
it's sad.
That was a smart decision, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. She's awesome. David, now's the time in the show where I give you the hosting mic. You get to ask me something. We've just met about 45 minutes ago. So based on what we've talked about or just what you're curious about, what would you like to ask me that I can answer for you and for the audience?
So I got two questions. I'm sure you've answered this before. I would say, like, what, if anything, did anything change about you during the pandemic, and how did your career change during the pandemic? So I'm really curious about this 2-year journey that we all collectively had to go on and what we did and what happened with it.
Mm-hmm. Great question. Nobody has asked me it in this specific way, so thank you. See, how has it changed? Well, that's an interesting question for me, because I was 8 months into my entrepreneurial journey when the pandemic hit. And my profession is I do executive and leadership coaching, mostly for tech companies, like tech founders, senior leaders of tech. I do a lot of facilitation work and I do training work. So I was already mostly virtual. So that part didn't really change for me. However, what did change is I was a WeWork fanatic. So I would go into the WeWork in our neighborhood. I had a WeWork Global Access membership. So I would go to the WeWorks in Midtown. I'd go to the WeWorks everywhere. So I had this life where I would get up in the morning, I'd drop my daughter off for preschool, and then I might be in Midtown. I might be at Times Square. I might be in Brooklyn Heights where we live, anywhere in between at a WeWork. And then it went from that to, I'm sitting at my house in the Catskills with my wife. My wife also working in a house that isn't really set up for two of us to work. It is now. We've both created an office spaces there. So for me, it wasn't so much what I was doing. It was more like the conditions of what it was inside of. And I was telling you this before the break or on the break. Internet, internet at WeWorks and in Brooklyn is really good. Internet where we moved to wasn't that great at the time. So that was a huge challenge. Like, how do my wife and I both work with low internet?
Did you find the environment of being in the startup environment, which is how WeWork, of course, builds itself. It's like everybody who's there, is in a startup environment. Did you find that fueled you?
Oh yeah. I'm 100% extroverted on the Myers-Briggs.
Right.
So,
so you're that guy that's going around talking to everybody at WeWork being like, tell me your story. Like, I keep running into
them
and I'm like, No.
So that's interesting. I'm a huge extrovert, but I don't like to bother people. So it's an interesting mix.
Fair.
I'm the guy who goes, I'm going to sit in the common space. I'm going to put on my headphones if I'm not doing anything, but I'm going to soak in the energy and just like what's going on around me. I'm a big, like, I feel the energy. So I'm not the dude who's going to like come up to you and be like, hey, so what are you working on? I'm not that guy. I mean, if we say hi, we're having a coffee, I'd say, hey, like, I'm Jason. Like a nice conversation. But that's an interesting thing. But so my business didn't change that much, except for the fact that a lot of the ways I generated clients is I'm a big networker.
Yeah.
So I was in a networking group. We met in Midtown every Thursday. I would meet people, do evening events. And I'm just a very social person. That was the big thing for me that changed tremendously for my business is how do I meet people? How do I talk to people? How do I get in front of people? Not just for business, but just for relationship building overall. How do I find good podcast guests when we're all locked up? And so that was the big change.
I did Lunch Club for a while. Do you know Lunch Club?
I'm on Lunch Club. I've done almost 100 Lunch Clubs. Yeah.
So I did a lot of Lunch Club during the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
For that exact same reason, being like, I miss going out to a bar and just striking up a random conversation with someone and be like, what are you doing? Or seeing colleagues in my industry or my former industry and saying, hey, what's everybody working on? What are you guys are doing? Right. And so,
yeah.
So Lunch Club was fascinating experiment for me. I have, cause I'm running two companies right now. I have lost the ability to give away an hour in my week. Right.
Like, I know. I'm kind of the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I imagine that they saw a lot of growth and then not.
Right. You know, I was just thinking about that with Lunch Club. I used to be pretty religious about doing two a week.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you the last time I've been able to make a regularly scheduled Lunch Club. They've also changed it where you can't tell them what times you're available. You have to say, I'd like to meet at this, which doesn't really work for me because I'm always going to put a podcast. I used to do some meetings Mondays at 9. I'm always going to meet with you and do a podcast with you before I'm going to do a Lunch Club because we're going to have a real awesome conversation. It's, you know, part of what I'm up to. And I'm still a member. I actually think I paused it last week, but I need to get back in there. And because I do love it. I love the idea of like, who's this person on the other line? And we're going to talk about, I've talked about Lunch Club on this podcast a few times. I would always go in, and because I'm a coach, I would go in and people are like, what do you do? I'm like, is that really what you want to talk about today? And a lot of times people will go, no, I'd either rather just tell you what's up. Like how, you know, like what, and I'll say, what do you want to talk about today? And I will say this, a plug for Lunch Club, of the 100 or so I've done, I would say 95 of the conversations have been delightful. Like really people, good people, just like, what are they up to? Sometimes we talk business, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we talk family, travel, really whatever people want to talk about. I've had a few where I'm just like, this is, you don't know me and you're pitching me on something. You don't even know if this is interesting to me. And you just go right into the pitch. It just doesn't work.
So I used Lunch Club for evil in the context of this conversation, right? Which was when the concept of what Gameotics does, my software company, which is just very briefly, it's real-time audience engagement for the live space, right? So live entertainment, museums,
that's cool,
sporting events, whatever it is, right? Where you're able to establish a two-way conversation with your fans, you know, collectively or even individually to allow them to have a gamified experience. It's a short pitch, right? The software was developed back in like 17, 18, and then it was always a side project. And then in January 20, I took it on full time and was starting to raise money, starting to build a company. And then of course, the pandemic and everything just went, you know, completely out of the window. So one of the things that I did is I moved everything I was doing up to Zoom, and we used Zoom as an entertainment platform. And then I spent, you know, 18 months use casing out the software and figuring out how it worked. Right. And part of that process was actually figuring out what I had. Because I would say in January 20, what I had then is 100% different than what I have right now.
Sure.
Right? I mean, and you hear that a lot. I mean, like in you know, founders' journeys, like Slack being one of the best examples of, you know, of so Slack isn't even the company that they founded.
No, it's like a gaming chat.
It's a great story. Yeah, it was a great story. I love that Slack story, right? So what, and like it's, my company is similar to what we founded, but it's wholly different right now. So anyway, so what I would use Lunch Club for is working out pitch messaging. Be like, they're like, oh, what are you working on? Right. And I would just pick and see if I would, and 90% of the time to these poor people on Lunch Club who'd I'd be matched with, like, it would be like, okay, I am speaking a foreign language to you. Okay. I don't have the right message yet. And I just do it every week. Right. And see him working. And it really did help because the thing that clinched it for me to get my seed investor, and this is a seed funding is from someone that I know who I've worked with before, but I've been talking to for months prior to them making the commitment, is I had been like working out the language, and finally got to get another meeting with this investor, and I say, oh, look, and we started talking, you know, like, all right, so where are you on, you know, the Gameotics and what's going on? I said, well, look, I figured it out. It's a two-way communication device between audience and content, right? And I had used that line, right, several times before, right? And I noticed that it started sparking, and they were like, wait, tell me more about that. And so when I said it to the investor, he said, in all the months we've talking, you finally explained what you're doing. This makes sense. Let's do a deal. Right.
Oh,
and so it's like,
So
it was great. But like, you know, at the same time, it was just like, I had my own purposes on Lunch Club just to figure out how to talk about this. Cause that was, I think to the networking standpoint, like that's what, you know, I'm a non-technical founder. I'm coming from entertainment, right? Like I'm not go through, I'm not, you know, in San Francisco, I'm not in that environment, right? I wasn't in WeWork. I wasn't around other startup founders except in the theatrical, which is its own bubble. And so it allowed me to talk to people in other industries to really sit down and learn how to talk about this software company that I have, right?
David, that's so good. We do have something in common here. I would use it for the reverse. So yeah. I would, as a coach, it's really all about mostly about listening. And so I would really work on my listening skills, and I would be listening for what's not being said and what is the view this person has of the world. And then in my mind, not everybody, it depends on who the person is. I think if you and I met, I would just been like really interested in what you're doing, because I'm a theater person and I'm a tech person. I would have been like, I want to hear about this thing just purely because it sounds cool. But for some people where they're either pitching me something or they're talking about something that is just, it's not in my world and not something I'm interested in, I was always thinking to myself, hey, if they came to me and I was their coach and they wanted coaching on what they're bringing, how would I show up for them? But like, you know, like role playing in my mind. But, you know, you're kind of inspiring me to get back into Lunch Club. I think I have one scheduled for this Friday. So we'll see. Well, I have like four I need to reschedule.
Especially if you're in the Catskills and you're not getting into the city as probably as much as you used to.
I used to live in the city.
There is something joyous about just meeting someone randomly, right?
It's great.
You know, like there is certainly something joyous about it. I mean, like I'm in Edinburgh. Like I said, I'm in Edinburgh right now. I am meeting lots of people right now, right?
Your target market too.
Full. Yeah.
And it sounds like it's
our target market. Full.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say about Lunch Club, then I've got a few more questions for you, is I'm a podcaster with a podcast called Talking to Cool People. So Lunch Club is definitely my spot. It's a spot that I would love. The reason I do this show is because I really genuinely like connecting with people and hearing what they're up to. And I think people are so fascinating. And man, David, you've inspired me. I'm like, oh, I've got like three Lunch Clubs I need to reschedule. They've hit me up on the messaging app and be like, oh, I do want to meet with this person. I really want to meet with this person. And we just haven't made it work. So you have personally inspired me to go and do that here when I have a few minutes today. And then I'll probably end up rescheduling.
Exactly. All right.
So David, what's the thing that you're most proud of?
Most proud of? This could come across so corny, but my marriage. Jacob and I have been together for almost 18 years this September.
Congrats.
We met when we were in our early 20s. We both worked in entertainment. He's as a performer for many, many years, and has now transitioned into being a personal trainer. And he met me when I was an assistant, right, to go on to become a lead producer on Broadway and producing a hit show and, you know, the things that I'm doing now. And, you know, who you are in your early 20s versus who you are in your early 40s are very different people, right? And your marriage, is a testament to how hard we have worked on us, especially with the amount that we both travel, because we've many, many months apart every year, right? Over the course of it. And learning that effective communication between the two of us helps me in my life, right? Like just helps me in my life all the place, and learning learning how to communicate like that. And so, it is something I'm very, very proud of. Like we are, to be able, as hard as it is, we're away for a month, we're gone from each other for a month this time, while I'm over here. It's just knowing that, you know, I get back and we jump right back into it, and then I'm home for 6 weeks and I'm gone for another month, and you know, and that we can withstand this, because I definitely have, you know, seen other friends and other relationships just fall apart under similar scenarios, and it's so I'm very, very proud of it that we've been together for certainly as long as we have, and obviously we're married and have a house together and pets and all that, but
fur babies, they're called fur babies
exactly. Right
now, congrats. I ask this question of everybody, and for people that are parents and or spouses, that's generally the answer. I don't think it's corny at all. I actually, you know, when people don't say that and I know they're married or they have children, I actually wonder what they're doing it all for.
Yeah.
Like that's actually what runs through my mind is, oh, so you're most proud. I don't know that I've ever had any parent on this show ever not say their children. Like that is the number one answer. If I was going to do a data analysis of the answers on these, if people have children every single time, it's what's the thing you're most proud of? My children. Yeah. If they're grown, whatever. So validating you that I do not believe that's corny. I think that is, and it's all, it also is the truthful answer, which is what makes it valuable.
So what's fun, right? So what's fun as gay men, right, is that you get to be insanely selfish, right? Like, you just get to be selfish, right?
Now you're making me jealous with a six-year-old and a one-year-old.
No. So because we made the decision not to have kids. Neither of us, you know, if you don't want to have children, you shouldn't have children. And neither Jacob and I are like, we don't want to have kids. We're good on this, right? So yeah. for 16 years of cats, right? Pretty easy. These cats are just as selfish as we are, right? So like a very easy relationship in that house, right? So, but we'd always wanted a dog. And the only thing that was holding us back from getting a dog after we moved to the suburbs, like we were living in Manhattan in an apartment, like tiny, tiny, tiny apartment, and couldn't get a dog there. Then we moved to the suburbs 7.5 years ago. We're like, oh, now it's time for a dog. I'm like, well, yeah, but we have these old cats, right? Like, you know, our cats,
they're not going to be happy about a puppy.
And they always say after a cat turns 10, like you've missed that window, right? Like the cat, like it's, you're just going to create. So it's like, are we waiting? So then we have these two old cats who just got older and eventually just got sicker. And then it's like, well, we can't get a dog. And so eventually the one cat died. And then my boy Spike passed away in March. And we were like, all right, you know, now it's time. And of course I was great. Like this cat was my best friend in the world. Like I love that cat.
Of course.
Right. Just absolutely, right. So I was grieving for a long time. And finally Jacob was like, we're getting a dog. You're going away this summer. You have a crazy year. It's like, it's going to happen. And I'm like, oh, I'm not ready. I'm not over my cat. And we show up. He was like, well, let's just go look, which was a lie, right? Which was a lie.
Come on. Nobody goes to the, to just look.
Like he caught me in my dream, right? He'd done all the paperwork. We'd gotten pre-approved. We go down to this animal rescue called Paws Crossed in Elmsford, New York, which is in Westchester. Sure. And we show up and we get up there and I'm like, okay. And I ask him, we're like, okay, our application's done. Like, so what's the next step? What's the next hurdle we have to jump? They're like, if you see a dog, you take a dog. And I was like, what? And Jacob's like,
wow, that's easy.
He's like, fooled you. So we met Willow, right? We get Willow, and we're like, all right, well, this dog is coming home for us. Like, you know, prior out of our cold dead hands, like this is our dog. And so we we get home. We're like, oh shit, we have a puppy now. And
we have a puppy.
A puppy that has turned out what we described earlier, just a lot of puppy.
Yeah.
And it was, and I know you know this as a parent, and I'm not making any comparison, but the thing about taking in that needy creature is for the first time in 18 years, it forced us to start thinking outside of ourselves for a minute. Right.
And that they don't use litter boxes.
Yeah, they do not. They are wholly dependent upon you. Right.
Yes, they are.
Unlike the cats who really don't care. And so that has been a great transition for both of us right now. And it was way harder on Jacob than it was on me. Because he has the more of the responsibility for raising the dog than I do right now.
Sure.
But it has been a really interesting moment for us in saying, gosh, like we now have to not just think about ourselves anymore. Right.
Yeah.
That's been great. And who would have thunk, right, that would have been a good thing for us. Right. Yeah. It's like we were doing great at ourselves, but this has been a really lovely learning experience for us. And I'm glad we've certainly had it at this point in our lives of saying, oh, you have to start thinking outside of yourself now, you know?
Yeah. So many things in that story. One of them is, nobody goes to an animal shelter to look. You know what to expect. You walk in and there's so many adorable kittens and puppies. No, you're like, you know what? We're definitely not getting one. We're just going to go look at these really cute little creatures that are needy, and knowing, depending on the type of shelter, that if they don't go home, it could be a big problem for them. Like,
There are no kill shelters. We do really well. We love, that's one of the reasons why we went there.
But yeah. I love that. Yeah. Dave, as we start to wrap up here, I call this my therapy question. Sit down, grab a box of Kleenex. Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. What's something you're afraid might actually be true about you?
Oh, that's an interesting question. What's something I'm afraid that might actually be true about me? It's that, again, and I'm sure you've heard this answer a lot, like that imposter syndrome, man, runs deep in any founder. It runs deep. And it's true in both of my startups right now, and actually just that constant fear of hovering on the edge. And I think the thing is, like, God, have I over-risked this, right? I think that's a really scary thing to confront, is saying, oh gosh, have I taken us too far somewhere, right?
Yeah.
That's terrifying, right? That's terrifying. It was my judgment bad, you know?
Yeah. So then what do you do to compensate for that?
Put my head down, do the work. Right.
Yeah, like, just grind it out.
De-risk it. Right. De-risk it. And the only way to de-risk it in that situation would be like, you know, build a better product. Right. Keep making it better.
I think that's a cool lesson that resonates for me as somebody who run my own business. I'm around a lot of people who run their own businesses. Like you said, I don't know anybody that either coach that I'm friends with. It doesn't matter. Most people who run their own businesses have that feeling. And most of us, myself included, compensate by heads down work, controlling what we can control, screaming into pillows sometimes, speaking for a friend, of course. I'm sure you've never had any moments where you're like, but just
yesterday, geez, I mean, yeah.
You're like, well, it's afternoon here. I've only done that twice this morning.
Exactly.
That's awesome. All right, David, how do you see the world?
Tough question these days, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, I try and take, it's tough. I mean, that's a really tough one. I mean, like I remember when Trump got elected and everybody was really, really down. I kept saying to people, it's like, look, first off, you know, I'm a firm believer. It's like, look, America is not one country. It's several countries, several very Agreed. Different countries cobbled together. I mean, it's literally was founded that idea, but it's not one country. And that's a really tough thing to recognize and understand. It still seems to work for the moment, but remember when Trump got elected and certainly, you know, there were, you know, people who were really down about it. On the left of saying, gosh, like one of the functions of this country and of this democracy is that it swings, right? And if you go back in its history, it has a tendency to swing really far right every once in a while. And you know, going all the way, you know, certainly you look at, there was a moment in this country where alcoholism had become such a problem in society that they banned alcohol.
I know,
and I don't
crazy.
Think any of us can contemplate. I mean, but we can contemplate that right now, right? And I think that's the thing that like with the Supreme Court allowing abortion to be banned state by state, right? Which is what happened. Which a prohibition was in a constitutional amendment, right?
Right.
That, you know, like we're probably not seeing a constitutional amendment about abortion either way right now.
No.
But that you see these wild swings, and so it's that the way they see the world is that we are on a constant pendulum, right? There is deep seated conservative religious thought that swings us right, you know, because they believe so passionately about it. And there's deep seated liberal and progressive belief that swings us back to the left. And the country doesn't have a tendency just to stay in the middle, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's tough.
I'm with
and
you.
That's tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up, I'd love to hear what you're up to in your company right now. What you're doing in Scotland, love to hear. And please, as we talk about this, how can people connect with this? Check out what you're doing, all that good stuff.
So Gameotix, so there's two companies right now. It's Gameotix and then it's 20 Sided Tavern, which I'll talk for a minute about, right? But Gameotix is it's a B2C company. It's a B2B company, right? Gameotix is providing a software solution in the live space to allow for connectivity and different types of experiences to be able to be built using the software, right? And so what we're out there doing is that we're currently right now in a massive overhaul of the technology, right? We are preparing ourselves to be SaaS ready by the beginning of October, which is not where it is right now, right? The software that I've been operating for the last 2 years has effectively been our MVP, and I've been able to build products on top of it, but it's not really ready for the next couple of months. So we're in the midst of doing this massive overhaul, and we're starting to prepare. We're working through our go-to-market strategy. We're working through all these things that we need to do to then start introducing the next, what we call 2.0, Gameotix 2.0 of the world, and really start saying, hey, we have this really powerful piece of software that can do a lot of things that nobody else can do that you never contemplated being able to do right now in the world, right? And so we're in that, you know, seed funded product development stage, and we're about just to go out the door and see what happens, right? That said, within all this, I have also built my first enterprise client, which is live action experience called 20 Sided Tavern. I built it for several reasons. One is because it's great, right? It's the best thing I've ever done in my life outside of my software company. But also, the challenge when you are doing what I'm doing in entertainment, and especially when it comes to technology or in the live space, is no one believes your tech works. Even when you tell them it does and show them videos that it does, no one believes you that it works, right?
Yeah.
And so it became a mission to build a product that on its own right, that can stand on its own 2 feet, right? Outside of Gameotix, I'm a partner in it, but outside of Gameotix, to prove to people that this thing works, right? The hard part about it, and I say this is the hard part, is the show isn't honest to God hit. Like, it is a hit experience. And so what 20-Sided Tavern is that it's a live action Dungeons and Dragons style gaming experience, right? Where your audience, a live entertainment audience, right, is using my software to participate in this game that's happening on stage, right? The idea is that everybody's got stakes, everybody's building the story together. And so you're building a product for this marketplace. And I would say it's the entirety of the Comic-Con marketplace. There's people who love gaming in their lives. There's people who love this type of experience, right? Who come in and see our show, and they have stakes and they have agency in the experience they're happening. And then it's never the same show twice because of that. So the variables from the choices that the audiences are making, it goes beyond poll, and there's a lot of mini games and things they have to do. The dice getting rolled on stage live, you dice cams up, you can see how the dice are getting rolled, to how the story is going through its various paths, right, have created this really unique, very exciting thing that is custom built for this audience. And so everywhere we go, we sell out the show at this point. Man. Right? So we have been selling out regularly here in Edinburgh at the Fringe Festival. It's getting 4-star reviews. We're getting, you know, great quotes right now. And we're starting to build this company. And this podcast comes out on a Wednesday, right?
Comes out on a Wednesday.
So theoretically tomorrow, and I might be a little ahead of it, but I might as well, I don't think I'm, is like we announce that we're going to Chicago this fall. And so we're going to leave Edinburgh, take a week off, and then we start building our Chicago. We're going to be in Chicago for 3 months this fall. And I won't say where, but, you know, leave that for the announcement, right? And so that will be the first commercial leg of the – we're out of development. We're into the commercial leg of the journey for the show. And what happened over here in Edinburgh was that we discovered that there is a global audience for this show, right? That this idea of gamification of experience, this idea of taking the concept of RPG gaming into the live entertainment space and giving the audience stakes and a way to play the show works like through and through. And it does it through and through. So 20-Sided Tavern's on its march forward now with Gamionics being the software solution for the engagement tech. So, yeah. So,
well, David, I will say this. You are talking to a future customer for sure. That is right in my wheelhouse. As like, I come from the tech world as well. And I was mentioning this to you. I really need to get you on my other podcast, talking to tech people, where we're just going to talk about the actual business, the tech. It's a more business focused podcast and the thought behind it. I'd love to have you on there, but I can tell you when this comes somewhere near me, if I'm traveling to Chicago, if I'm in New York, I will definitely do this. This is like my jam. Like, I like interactivity and I like tech. I like that combination too of the, it's happening live on stage. Cause I'm a big theater person as well. Like, I like to go to the theater. So that sounds really cool. So congratulations. What a cool concept.
This has been one of the hardest, but the most fun things I've ever done. And far and away, it's the best. Like I said earlier, it's the best thing I've ever done. I have two partners in this venture who are amazing. They're the creators of it. And then we all run the company together. So I'm building a startup with two people that I absolutely love. And like, we have gone through the fire here in Edinburgh to do the show. And like, it just keeps selling out. So we're really thrilled.
You're doing what every founder dreams of, finding product market fit.
Yeah.
There's a market for what you've done. And I'm sure you know a lot of founders too. Like, man, I thought this was a good idea. And then we get it out there and people just,
Well, the hard thing, land. And we talk about this in the business podcast, is the hard thing is when investors say to you, well, you're your own client. So I don't believe this. Right. And I'm like, no one else is going to build. Like, what are you talking about? Of course I'm my own client. Look, I'm selling tickets, like selling out. Like, where are you not? And it's just this weird Silicon Valley craziness that takes over. Oh, well, I could never possibly believe in what you're doing. Okay. Like, all right, fine.
Whatever,
dude. Like, I'll let the numbers speak for it. So,
yeah, that's awesome, David. Well, as we wrap up here, love to get some short and sweet words of wisdom that would fit on an Instagram post. So what do you have for all of us here listening and with us, short and sweet words of wisdom?
Whenever someone says to you, oh, you must be passionate about this in a condescending voice, ignore it.
Oh, that's such good advice. That's the startup version of the Southern, oh, bless your heart.
Oh, you're so passionate about this. Yeah, I work 80 hours a week. Well, of course I am.
I'm passionate.
Like, how is that a detriment?
I know. That's so good, so David. Stupid. I'm so glad you got a chance to do this. You're we're going to get you set up in my other podcast as well. We'll talk more about Gameiotics. I want to say congratulations to you and Jacob on the new fur baby.
Thank you.
A fellow puppy lover. And also, Jacob, I hope you listen to this. God bless you being home alone with a puppy.
Yeah. David's doing, send him all your love.
And you've obviously got a keeper here, David, as somebody who's willing to do that while you're out doing the thing. So good to have you on, and just continued success to you. And we'll get you. We'll talk to you on the other podcast soon.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks David. Yep. Bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Talking to Cool People with Jason Frizzell. If you enjoyed today's episode, please tell your friends, follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and give us a shout out. Or take a moment to leave a review on iTunes. If something from today's episode piqued your interest and you'd like to connect, email us at podcast@jasonfrizzell.com. We love hearing from our listeners because you're cool people too.